ashamed of my weakness and my misplaced loyalty, of the things I did for Mr. Trump in an effort to protect and promote him. I am ashamed that I chose to take part in concealing Mr. Trump's illicit acts rather than listening to my own conscience. I am ashamed because I know what Mr. Trump is. He is a racist, he is a con man, and he is a cheat.
Michael Cohen sat in front of the House Oversight and Reform Committee for hours today, implicating President Donald Trump in bank fraud, tax fraud, and campaign finance felonies. The hearing immediately got off to a contentious start when Ohio Republican Jim Jordan tried to postpone it.
You get to deviate from the rules.
Regular order.
I just have a simple motion, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
It's regular order to have the testimony 24 hours in advance.
Excuse me.
Okay, well, that was rebuffed. Overall, Democrats took a gentle tact with Cohen as they tried to coax out incriminating information on the president and his associates. Here's Carolyn Maloney of New York.
Michael, can you suggest who else this committee should talk to for additional information on this or anything else?
Yes, I believe David Pecker, Dylan Howard, Barry Levine of AMI as well, Alan Weisselberg, Alan Garten of the Trump Organization as well.
Well, thank you very much for your testimony. And Mr. Chairman, this is a story of redemption.
Thank you, ma'am.
Republicans, though, tried to hammer Cohen, repeatedly interrupting him and challenging his testimony. Here's Arizona's Paul Gosar.
Right in front of this committee, you conflicted your testimony, sir. You're a pathological liar. You don't know truth from falsehood.
Sir, I'm sorry. Are you referring to me or the president?
Hey, this is my time.
Are you referring to me, sir, or the president?
When I ask you a question, yes. I'll ask for an answer.
Sure.
Okay, political theater for sure. What have we learned? And what does it mean for the investigation into Russian interference in the election and whether or not Donald Trump was part of that interference? We have a panel to help us understand what happened today. Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and a regular Legal Eagle. Hi, Jessica.
Hi.
Also joining us, Melanie Zanona, congressional reporter for Politico. Hi there.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Fred Smoller, political science professor at Chapman University. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you too. And McKay Coppin, staff writer at The Atlantic. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, McKay, let's begin with you. Certainly riveting testimony, but any huge revelations, any bombshells, things we didn't already know?
Well, you know, I think you can separate the revelations or the claims that Michael Cohen made in this testimony into two categories. One are the revelations directly connected to matters of ongoing investigation. So he said that President Trump had a heads up about WikiLeaks publishing the Clinton campaign emails in the election. He claimed that there was he had reason to believe, though he didn't know for sure, that Trump might have known about the meeting at Trump Tower during the campaign with a Kremlin-connected lawyer. These are things that he has either said in public or suggested in public, or we've seen reporting on, but he's now saying them under oath, so that matters somewhat. The other category of revelations, I think, that are also interesting are speak directly to President Trump's character. You played at the beginning their audio of Michael Cohen saying that President Trump is a racist. And as evidence for that, he pointed to specific statements that the president had made in his presence about black people. And while, you know, some people listening to this probably have already made up their minds about President Trump's racism one way or the other, to hear the president's former personal attorney, who has spent a long time with him, make these claims and recount these conversations, I think matters.
Okay,
so,
let's hear that, actually.
We heard about that.
Yeah, well, we have that tape. Let's hear it.
Mr. Trump is a racist. The country has seen Mr. Trump court white supremacists and bigots. You have heard him call poorer countries assholes. In private, he is even worse. He once asked me if I could name a country run by a black person that wasn't a asshole. This was when Barack Obama was president of the United States. And while we were once driving through a struggling neighborhood in Chicago, he commented that only black people could live that way. And he told me that black people would never vote for him because they were too stupid. And yet, I continued to work for him.
Okay, Melanie Zanona at Politico, Elijah Cummings, African-American running that committee. What was his reaction, and what was the general reaction to that kind of revelation?
Yeah, I mean, these claims have been made in other reports before. Obviously, the S-hole Nation comments were reported last year, so it wasn't entirely surprising. But look, when I talk to lawmakers, they say these are the sorts of things, not necessarily the legal things, but the political ramifications and the unsavory headlines that could really cause a problem for Trump in 2020, especially among those moderate and independent lawmakers who aren't really sure about whether they're still backing the president. Maybe they voted for him in 2016, but these sorts of unsavory details just really don't rub them the right way. And look, the lawmakers themselves have called Trump racist before. Obviously, Mark Meadows, one of Trump's top allies, did seek to defend him. That was one of the rare instances, actually, I would say, that we really heard Republicans go out of their way to defend the president as opposed to focusing on tarnishing and trashing Cohen himself. And Meadows said there are African-Americans who work for Trump himself and have never experienced this. But Cohen said, look, I know this guy. I have been with him for many years in intimate settings. He's had dinners with him, and this was his assessment.
Pretty devastating.
Exactly.
Fred Smoller, you're taking sort of a longer look at this in connection with past scandals, perhaps Watergate. How does this rank today's testimony, do you think?
Where's the beef?
Yeah.
Where's the
collusion, in other words?
Well, Donald Trump, we know, is a vile human being, but I didn't hear anything so far that is indeed impeachable or that would lead to impeachment. Donald Trump is most worried about his political standing and the possibility of impeachment. And in terms of political standing, his base is not going to be, will probably be attracted to some of the things that are said about him. And the people who don't like him already know that he is a racist, philanderer, and a genuine hypocrite and slimeball. But that's priced in to his public support. The only people I think are going to benefit from this are SNL and the late-night comedians who will be able to do increased impersonations of Michael Cohen and perhaps Donald Trump Jr. But I didn't hear anything like we heard when we heard the Watergate hearings 40 years ago, where Mr. Butterfield revealed that there was a taping system. Mm-hmm. Well, that was new.
Yeah.
But nothing here.
Okay. Jessica Levinson, what about from a legal perspective? Anything jump out at you that points to possible legal trouble for anyone, including Donald Trump, whom Cohen mentioned today?
Well, plenty of potential legal trouble, but nothing new in terms of legal questions. And so what I think, frankly, is new, which I'm just going to echo what everybody's saying, is we've seen all of these allegations before. We've either seen them from Michael Cohen, not before Congress. We've seen them in sentencing memorandum from Robert Mueller, or we've seen them in other investigations, for instance, in the Southern District. I would say the one piece that a couple of people are latching onto, and I think that's exactly right, is this comment by Mr. Cohen that he is involved in another kind of undisclosed investigation in the Southern District of New York. That, to me, is legally absolutely fascinating, but we basically know nothing about it. In terms of, is there anything today that gives rise to an impeachable offense? I would say nothing new. And therefore, to me, the legal issues and the political issues are really wrapped up. And I don't see this changing the political issue other than it's just harder for Republican lawmakers to go back to their districts and defend the president when he's been called a racist on TV as opposed to, for instance, in written form.
Okay, well, let me ask you about one aspect of the testimony, and that is the quote-unquote hush money paid to porn star Stormy Daniels. And he testified today, Cohen testified today, that Donald Trump paid him back for paying off Stormy Daniels while he was president. So this was in 2017. Here's a clip of tape from that.
Wasn't sure if she was really going to go public. There was, again, some communications back and forth between myself and Keith Davidson. And ultimately, it came to either do it or don't. At which time, again, I had gone into Mr. Trump's office, as I did after each and every conversation. And he had told me that he had spoken to a couple of friends, and it's $130,000. It's not a lot of money, and we should just do it. So go ahead and do it.
Okay, so would that be illegal, A, that he directed this funding, and B, that he paid back Cohen during the presidency?
Yes, but I would say that's what we essentially have already known based on, again, the Mueller investigation and the sentencing memorandum and what's happened in the Southern District of New York. But yet, to your question, yes, you don't get to do that. I mean, so what we're looking at is either a excessive contribution. It's way over the, for instance, $2,700 limit that you can give to a federal candidate. So it's excessive, it's unreported, and or it's an unreported loan. So you don't get to just say to somebody, why don't you essentially give a huge in-kind contribution to the campaign, but don't worry, I'll pay you back after, and candidates can spend unlimited sums on their own candidacies. That doesn't allow you to escape liability. And the fact that the president is repaying as the president of the United States, I don't think matters. It matters that he's repaying what I view as an in-kind contribution to his campaign for president.
Although, again, he doesn't say expressly, this is money for Stormy Daniels. He says, here's just a check, and maybe it's just paying off Michael Cohen for something else. So who knows, a retainer fee or something.
And that's why these campaign finance questions are so difficult. But we have Michael Cohen saying in open court, he told me to make this payment. It was in furtherance of the campaign. And that's why he pled guilty to those campaign finance violations. And that's why I view the president really as akin to an unindicted co-conspirator when it comes to these federal election law violations.
McKay Coppins, what about the moment where he talked about Roger Stone and WikiLeaks? So Michael Cohen saying that Donald Trump knew from conversations with Roger Stone that WikiLeaks was going to release material stolen from the DNC before it happened. But in the New York Times, just a little short while ago, Trump told reporters there in that interview, he never spoke to Stone about that.
That's right. This has been something that the president has repeatedly denied. Although, you know, if you rewind back to the campaign, and it's easy to forget because it feels like an eternity ago, but the president was actually openly advocating for the Russians to find Hillary Clinton's deleted emails. You'll recall that in a press conference, he actually explicitly said that. So while the president has more recently denied, cooperating or working with WikiLeaks or even being aware of what WikiLeaks is doing, whether or not that ends up being true, it is obviously the case, and this was in plain sight, that the president was kind of advocating for the Hillary Clinton's emails to be released by any hackers who might have them back during the election.
Right. But so that is a direct contradiction to what he has said the entire time.
That's right.
Another direct contradiction that Michael Cohen brought up today was involving this Trump Tower deal in Moscow. So Donald Trump repeatedly during the campaign was saying he knew nothing, he had no business in Russia, he knew nothing about it, no business at all. And today, Michael Cohen said he did in fact have business in Russia, and he talked about it. He managed it during the campaign the whole time. Melanie Zanona, was that a revelation for you covering this?
Well, we had heard these accusations before. However, on this piece of it, I will say there was one bit of new information that you've already heard Democrats really seizing on, and that's that Michael Cohen said he met with Trump lawyers before giving his testimony on this issue, which, of course, is the reason he is partly going to jail, is because he lied about one of these issues to Congress. But he said that he met with Trump lawyers and they changed his testimony. He did not give many details about what exactly was changed, and he didn't really say he was directed to lie. But I think Democrats are really looking into that, and that raised a lot of our eyebrows. Like, what was he told? What was said in that meeting? What was changed? So I think that's something you could definitely see Democrats pursuing. They said they want to keep lines of inquiry that pop up from today on the table so they can come back and investigate it. You heard Cohen made some suggestions as well about who he thinks they should haul in, such as Ivanka Trump, Eric Donald Trump Jr., some of the kids, Alan Weisselberg.
Yeah, tell us more about Alan Weisselberg, because his name kept coming up. Tell us about his role.
So, I mean, he's the CFO of the Trump Organization. So he is someone who knows intimate details about the organization, how it operated. And I talked to one of the oversight members when they had a little break in this hearing just a few moments ago, Jerry Connolly of Virginia, and he said he definitely wants to bring them in. So I think we could actually see Weisselberg be one of the next high-profile hearings that we have. However, when it comes to the kids, he said things get messy when you bring in kids. It could get a little – looks like it's partisan. It could be a double-edged sword bringing the kids in. So I think there's some more debate about that. But certainly other members are going to be hauled in going forward here.
Let me just play another clip of tape regarding this Moscow Trump Tower deal. And this is over the disputed BuzzFeed story. BuzzFeed reported and was the only organization to report that Donald Trump directed Michael Cohen to lie before Congress about the timing of this project. Even Robert Mueller came out and said, no, that's not true. And here is Cohen being asked about that today.
Mr. Trump did not directly tell me to lie to Congress. That's not how he operates. In conversations we had during the campaign, at the same time I was actively negotiating in Russia for him, he would look me in the eye and tell me there's no Russian business, and then go on to lie to the American people by saying the same thing. In his way, he was telling me to lie.
Jessica Levinson, is that something that could be parsed in terms of a legal ramification?
Absolutely. And I think this, as you said, this goes to the heart of the BuzzFeed article in which the article basically said that President Trump directed him explicitly and said, you should lie to Congress. And this, frankly, I think gives a much more realistic portrait of what happens in the real world when there's a potential conspiracy, a criminal conspiracy, to file false statements with Congress. And that is that you don't have that smoking gun moment where you say, I would really like you to lie to Congress. Instead, you can speak in generalities, you speak in codes, and you make it known what you want. So I don't think that this would allow the president, if we found that the president could be indicted, to escape liability. It certainly makes it a more difficult case, but it also makes it, frankly, to me, a more believable story of how people actually communicate and the challenges that prosecutors face when they're trying these types of cases.
Right. Now, Fred Smoller, you've said, okay, where's the beef? There's no smoking gun. There's no hidden tape recording system. However, taking all of these bits and pieces and the way Trump communicated and all of the stuff that you heard today, what is the bigger picture that you have?
Well, I think first there's another foot to drop, and that is going to be Donald Trump, and he's going to respond forcefully, as he always does, and he's going to call this fake news. He's going to say nasty things about CNN. The White House is going to say nastier things about Michael Cohen, and then they're going to say this is all about sour grapes, that the Hillary Clinton didn't win, and now they're trying to undermine the choice of the American people for the presidency. So I think we have to wait to his response. But again, at this point, I don't see them moving forward with impeachment based on what they will call campaign finance violations. They'll pay a fine and call them that. And then with the other things, well, we knew that how he treats and thinks of women. But I don't, unless we see the smoking gun of Michael Cohen saying Vladimir Putin gave President Trump $1 million for his campaign or his inauguration, and in return he wanted easing up on the sanctions regarding Ukraine or the Soviet or the Russians, I don't see it really changing his political posture.
Hmm. Okay, so he did, Michael Cohen, answer a lot of questions about his relationship with Trump and other people he was representing when he was an attorney. I just want to talk about sort of the Republican strategy here, because he, as I mentioned, they're trying to paint him as someone who's unreliable, who may have other motivations for coming forward, who is a convicted felon, convicted of lying, lied before Congress, so why should we believe him now? And then there is this interesting side note of attorney-client privilege. Like, is he even, you know, if he was a lawyer in good standing, he's no longer a lawyer, he was disbarred yesterday. But if he were a lawyer in good standing, would he do this? Is it possible under attorney-client privilege to spill all these secrets of his main client? And here is an exchange with North Dakota Republican Kelly Armstrong.
When you said you had 100 tapes, were any of those tapes of other clients?
Yes.
And I think this is pretty amazing. I really do. Did any of them waive privilege?
Nope.
So 5 minutes ago, in the middle of our hearing on oversight, you just immediately responded that you would hand over tapes to this committee without any of your previous clients waiving privilege.
I'm not the only one in possession of those documents. Those documents are in the hands of all of the agencies.
Whoever else is in charge of those documents is not my concern. My concern is I know lawyers that would go to jail before they would violate attorney-client privilege. And in a matter of a second, you just said, absolutely, I will turn those over.
Just trying to cooperate, sir.
Okay, so Jessica, Cohen Singh has all these tapes of his conversations with other clients, and I guess other clients being the other two clients he had, and that's Elliot Brady and Sean Hannity, and that he's ready to turn them over. Is it a crime to turn over these tapes? And where is the attorney-client privilege line on this with him testifying all about Donald Trump?
Yeah, absolutely. This is a great question because he is a lawyer and he's testifying about his client. But talking to an attorney, it's not like having a wizard in the room. It's not that everything you say is protected by the attorney-client privilege or a separate duty, which is the duty of confidentiality. So what you need to have is a communication where you're giving legal advice. So Michael Cohen is free to talk about any communications that don't fall within that bucket. I mean, for instance, you and I could form an attorney-client privilege on limited issues where you could say, can I ask for your opinion on this specific instance? It doesn't mean that everything we talk about before or after is privileged. The other thing I would say is there's a quote-unquote crime-fraud exception to the attorney-client privilege, which means that it's exactly as it sounds like. If they're undertaking a criminal fraud, then you no longer have the attorney-client privilege. But I do think that, and certainly pending any sort of court orders, you can break the attorney-client privilege. But the point here is I think that they're trying to make Michael Cohen out to look like a liar, like he's not credible, which frankly, we already knew. I mean, there wasn't much lower to go on the credibility scale here. Mm-hmm. And so it is true that Michael Cohen should not just hand over tapes in which he might have had privileged communications with other clients. That is, the holder of that privilege is the client. He would have to heavily redact those tapes in order to hand them over, as far as I know.
All right. Melanie Zanona, finally, I think one of the more eye-raising, or maybe not eye-raising, but just interesting points that he made was that Donald Trump never thought he would be president of the United States. And he basically said he thought this would be the greatest infomercial in political history. And obviously, that's not a legal matter, but a political matter. Do you think that that will resonate with his base in a negative way at all?
You know, I think at the end of the day, most people are pretty dug in. I don't see this hearing doing much to sway in the court of public opinion. Of course, it's a very unsavory thing to hear. It's not going to be a good headline for the president among many that will come out of this hearing, but I do think at the end of the day, not a lot of people are going to be changing their minds either about Cohen or about President Trump himself. And I think that's why you've heard a lot of Democrats really exercise some restraint on the impeachment issue after this hearing. Some of the lawmakers I was talking to said, you know, we're not ready to go down that road. That's not the point of this hearing. Republicans have tried to make it out that way, suggesting Tom Steyer is like secretly involved in all this and trying to get Cohen to testify and put pressure on these guys to impeach. But, you know, back to your original question, no, I don't think this is going to make much of a difference at the end of the day when it comes to Trump supporters.
Okay, we will leave it there. Much, much more TBD. Melanie Zanona, congressional reporter for Politico. Fred Spoehler, professor of political science at Chapman University. Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School. And McKay Coppin, staff writer at The Atlantic and author of The Wilderness, a book about the battle over the future of the Republican Party. Thank you all so much. Coming up, Why is California's Attorney General trying to get reporters to destroy a list of police officers convicted of crimes? That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. There is a list out there. It contains the names of thousands of California police officers who have been convicted of a crime in the past decade. That list is private, but reporters for the investigative reporting program at UC Berkeley got the list. They wrote about it. Now California Attorney General Javier Becerra is threatening legal action. One of those reporters is Robert Lewis, and he joins me now. Hi.
Hello.
Okay. First of all, tell me about this list and how you got it.
So what we have is a list of approximately 12,000 individuals, current former peace officers, as well as applicants, people who are trying to become cops, who have been convicted of a crime at some point in the last decade. Got it through a Public Records Act request to this body in the state. It's called the Commission on Peace Officer Standards and Training. It's basically an accrediting body. Put in a public records request seeking records of officers, current, former, who'd been convicted of crimes, and this is what they sent us.
So they actually sent it to you, and did they do so in their minds erroneously?
Well, I mean, that's the question now. So I submitted my public records request in early December. There was a number of emails back from them, sort of the standard, acknowledging receipt. They said they were researching the request and what could be released under the law. And then they sent the email sending the actual records. After we got the records, I started asking questions of clarification, which is sort of normal when you get records, that especially ones you've never seen before. You just want to make sure that you're understanding them, reading them correctly. And I spent 3 weeks sort of hounding them, trying to find out more information. And then all of a sudden on January 29th, so 3 weeks after I got the records, I got a letter from the state attorney general's office saying that they had been inadvertently released, that it was a misdemeanor, a crime to possess the records, and basically demanding that we destroy the records and certify destruction or face legal action.
Which you did not do.
We did not do. That is correct.
You wrote about it. And did you publish any names from that list?
Just a few so far. I mean, we are trying to be due diligence, as you might imagine. The database, I should say this, the records don't make clear which individuals were actual cops, as opposed to, say, you know, some 18-year-old kid who was applying to be a cop. And so, you know, we're trying to figure out who some of these individuals are, and that's the due diligence we're doing. So, but I have looked at a number of cases. I've gone to various courthouses, and I did, just to give a little smattering, publish a few of the cases that I've looked at.
So out of that list of 12,000 or so, you don't know how many of those actually became police officers. So this list was actually done as a way to background check people who are applying to be a cop.
Sort of. So POST, as this sort of accrediting body, keeps a database of people who are post-certified law enforcement officers, were post-certified law enforcement officers, or people who are in the process of getting this certification. And within this data, they of course want to keep information on whether or not people have convictions on their record that should disqualify them from being in law enforcement. And so historically, POST has only labeled someone as disqualified in their database when that person was convicted and exhausted all appeals. And it was that last clause that was sort of problematic for POST, because, appeals could drag out for years, and the agency is just not set up to really be tracking court cases that way. So there was a technical change to the law there in the sort of public safety omnibus bill last year that basically struck that last clause. So as soon as someone is convicted, Post can now label them as disqualified. And to be able to update its records, they requested and got from DOJ this list of basically, hey, here's everybody who might be in your database who has a conviction on their record. And it's my understanding that Post was going to then take that list, go through, figure out which ones were truly disqualified, and sort of update their records to reflect who shouldn't be in law enforcement.
So does anybody really know definitively if people who are now in law enforcement, cops who are on the beat, if you will, whether or not they should be based on past criminal convictions?
I mean, we do not know the actual numbers based solely on this list. We attempted to get that. That was some of the clarification we were seeking, and they just, you know, DOJ would not give us any more information. And we were able to sort of match up the database with personnel records, some personnel databases, and we can see that there are some really strong name matches. We found, you know, nearly 4,000 names in the convictions database that match names in the personnel database. But certainly there's going to be some false positives. We also know that we probably missed some. So it requires a significant amount more work, at least on our effort, to confirm that without any more information coming from the agencies.
Okay, so we asked Becerra's office to respond to this, and why they sent you that letter telling you to destroy the list. And they said, they gave us a statement, and they basically say in the statement, and I'll just read one section of it, the information is private data compiled from records in these various databases. They are confidential records about all Californians, not just police officers, and you shouldn't have this list because it's private. And state law protects the records of Californians in this database, and basically the law does not allow Post, this agency, to release that data. What do you say to all that?
Well, I mean, that is their position. I would just say that Post considered our Public Records Act request and came to a determination that they could release this list. After the fact, DOJ has come to a different determination. I'm not an attorney. I'm not arguing in court whether or not it should have been released under the Public Records Act request. But those are the simple facts of the matter.
I mean, do you see this as a First Amendment issue? I immediately thought of the Pentagon Papers because that was a similar claim about right to privacy and the media's not allowed to have private records, private information. Obviously, these are different circumstances, but do you see any parallels?
Well, I hesitate to put it in the same category as the Pentagon Papers.
But, I mean, as a landmark case, obviously.
Correct. You know, I do think it's a First Amendment issue. I mean, I believe, I know my reporting partners believe, and the news outlets we work with believe that these records, or many of these records, are in the public interest. The public certainly has an interest in knowing when their police officers are convicted of crimes. And you know, I also think it's a little bit stunning that the top law enforcement official in the state would be threatening, bordering on threatening criminal prosecution for reporters for having records, which, you know, these are not some sort of secret, unfounded complaints or allegations. These are actual criminal convictions. You can go to the courthouse and pull these files. So to sort of maintain that the public does not have a right to know when police officers are convicted of a crime, or when there is a list of police officers convicted of a crime, that the public does not have a right to have that information. I do think that's a First Amendment issue.
Yeah, and we should stress that this isn't just an accusation. This is an actual conviction.
Correct. These are actual convictions. There was an arrest, there was an accusation, formal criminal charges. It went through the full legal proceedings, and at the end of it, it came out that this individual committed a crime and is convicted of a crime.
All right, Robert. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That's Robert Lewis. He is with the Investigative Reporting Program at UC Berkeley. Coming up in the mid-90s, punk rock made a big comeback starting right here in California. But some of the new punks were actually intellectuals.
Greg Graffin, or the professor, is who is the singer in Bad Religion, not only does he have a PhD, he's actually the professor of evolutionary biology at Cornell University.
Punk's Second Coming, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Punk rock has its roots in late 70s, New York and London, bands like the Sex Pistols, the Ramones, the Damned. But if you first learned of those bands from T-shirts at your local mall's Hot Topic, you grew up in a different era. The so-called second wave, with bands like Bad Religion, The Offspring, Green Day.
Do you have the time to listen to me whine about nothing and everything all at once?
These California bands are credited, or more accurately, criticized by some punk purists for mainstreaming the angry, rebellious spirit of the genre and selling millions of albums in the process. Basically, popifying punk. Thankfully, this debate is no longer settled in the mosh pits of grimy clubs, but explored in books. Ian Winwood is the author of the new book, Smash, Green Day, The Offspring, Bad Religion, NoFX, and the 90s punk explosion. And he joins us from London. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Let's talk about this second wave of punk. So you pin it on the year 1994.
In 1994, yeah. Two bands in particular. A lot of groundwork was laid by other bands, and by these two bands in particular. Green Day up in the Bay Area and Offspring from Orange County. And they released two albums, Dookie by Green Day and Smash by The Offspring. Smash, interestingly, being released on a very small Los Angeles independent record label called Epitaph. And in the spring of 1994, both of those albums hit in enormous quantities. I mean, millions upon millions upon millions of albums.
And those represent the two, you know, Northern and Southern California, right? Green Day from
That's right.
Northern California, The Offspring from here in Southern California. How are the mm-hmm. two sounds different?
I think the distinction between the two areas is actually one of class. The Offspring, Bad Religion, NoFX, Pennywise, all of those Southern Californian bands, as great as they are, all their members came from, at the very least, middle, lower middle, and upper class middle households, all of whom had backup plans, college educations.
Yeah, and two of the bands, The Offspring and Bad Religion, have PhD musicians in them.
That's right. Greg Graffin, or the professor, is who is the singer in Bad Religion. Not only does he have a PhD, he's actually the professor of evolutionary biology at Cornell University.
Really?
They're book smart people. Mm. Up north, Green Day, I remember once asking Billy Joe Armstrong, the singer in Green Day, what he would have done were it not for music. And he said, probably I would have been a TV repairman or a pool cleaner. And he didn't sound particularly bothered by that. And he's sort of at the higher end of the Bay Area social spectrum. The band Rancid, punks reluctant to admit that the second wave is any good, tend to like Rancid. I mean, they would probably be dead, possibly, at least some of the members, without the salvation of music.
I have to ask you, you're obviously English, and yeah. You know, a lot of great punk came from England, Sex Pistols, for example. And what is your interest, though, in this California punk rock? Is it exotic for you?
Well, for one thing, there's a school of thought that says that English punk died when the Sex Pistols put out their first album. And there's something to that. It burnt impossibly bright and impossibly intensely and then flickered out. So I would only ever have been looking at this music as a young listener. You know, I was much, much too young. I was an infant when this all happened. Whereas I was just starting out as a music journalist when the second wave, you know, really caught wind. There was, I suppose, something exotic in the fact that at that time I'd never been to America. But also, there weren't any English bands like that, you know? I don't think I was prejudiced against English music. There were no English punk rock bands, really. And those that there were certainly not of the quality of the ones, you know, that about which I write in the book. I mean, so much of this I genuinely think is world-class music.
So talk about that, because you do have these seminal punk bands from an earlier era, maybe just, you know, maybe 10 years previously, here in Southern California. You have X.
Hello.
Black Flag, The Germs. I'm sure that there is a conflict between the people who are fans of those bands and even those bands themselves and these ones that you're talking about in the 90s.
The trouble with the LA scene was, the original LA scene was, its brilliance was its downfall. It was so violent, it was so nihilistic, it was so sonically shocking that it couldn't sustain that kind of level of fury that a band like Fear and Black Flag. And the good bands sort of reinvented themselves. X did and mutated. Mm-hmm. Black Flag just got stranger. But a lot of them just weren't good enough to execute a second act. The interesting thing about the second wave is that the bands have made it last. And that, I think, is the crucial difference. One of the most disheartening things about when the explosion happened in 94 was punks who saw the original wave were very, very quick, generally speaking, very quick to dismiss it as being fake and fraudulent. This is nonsense, by the way. As I said, prior to Green Day and The Offspring, no American punk band had become successful. So by definition, all of these bands got together with no expectation of success. The most they could hope for was what Bad Religion had achieved, which was, to play at the Hollywood Palladium. There was nothing beyond that. There were 100,000 people who would identify as punks in the United States, and that was it. Old school punks who dismissed the newer wave were being reactionary and rather close-minded, which was actually very disappointing because we can drive ourselves mad wondering what punk rock is and isn't.
Well,
closed-minded, it's not supposed to be.
Right, but when you think of punk rock, you see it as its very definition is rebelling against the establishment. So when you see a Green Day selling millions of records and becoming, having a show on Broadway, that's not exactly rebelling against the establishment.
Well, I mean, that's one of the definitions of punk, but you could trace it back. I'm not sure how the Ramones ever really rebelled against the establishment. I mean, they were sort of like, a lovable band. They might as well have been Muppet characters, really. So, yes, you're right. A band such as the Dead Kennedys and, the originals, the Sex Pistols, when they were first heard, it must have been impossibly shocking. But you can only shock and threaten for so long. And then a genre, no longer does that. Gangster rap once did that, and it doesn't anymore.
Yeah.
That moves on.
Let's hear a song from Bad Religion. This one, 1,000 More Fools. And this is really the band, you say, sparked the reemergence.
I heard them say that the beach are ain't on earth. Fantastical myriads of saving call it birth. I've seen the rapture and a scar of baby's eyes. Inchoate Peter to the Lord of the Flies. So what does it mean?
So yeah, there you have a more intellectual approach. He's actually referencing Lord of the Flies, a book.
Yeah, right.
And that goes to your thesis that these bands actually had something to say.
The song that you played there is from the album Surfer, which Bad Religion released in 1988, almost by accident. Bad Religion were essentially in mothballs because Graffin was away at school. And Epitaph Records was also in mothballs. So they just recorded an album, put it out, sold 10,000 copies, then 20,000 copies. But I really do make the case very strongly in the book. It kept the pilot light of punk rock alive. And without it, it might have flickered out and died because gangster rap had taken away the genre's ability to shock. Thrash metal and bands like Slayer had taken away its sonic fury. And it just appeared to be a busted flush. Yet here was something, as you rightly say, that was something slightly different. It had punk's energy. But it was, if not intellectual, then certainly intelligent. They're the most important band in the story that I tell, without question.
Also important, The Offspring. And they are also on Epitaph. I want to play a song called Come Out and Play.
Separated.
So that's a song about gang violence here in LA?
It is, yeah. The writer of that song, Dexter Holland, who sings and sometimes plays guitar in The Offspring, was a student at USC, and he would drive to school. And this is at the time that really the Offspring were, as most of these bands were, certainly in Southern California, they were part-time bands. And he would drive to school through, you know, neighborhoods that were, you know, affected by crime and drugs and gun violence and gang activity. And he would just observe this. And you know, the song became an enormous hit. I mean, an enormous hit. And it was on MTV all the time. You know, in a sense, it's a very jaunty song. You might even say that it almost sounds like a novelty song, although I wouldn't necessarily go that far. But it's told expertly. He's only ever an observer in the lyric, and I think it's a very sophisticated and very underrated song.
This is a pretty white scene, though, right? By and large, I mean, he's talking about gang violence, but this is a white band.
By and large, it's white. You know, it's white males. That said, you look back. This is one of the points I make in the book. You look back on music from the late 80s and the early 90s. A good many allowances have to be made for it. You know, certainly Guns N' Roses. You need to make allowance for some of the things that they're saying. A lot of hip hop, even the Beastie Boys were going to title their first album "Don't Be a Faggot." I don't know if I can say that word, but that's what they were going to call it. Thankfully, for all concerned, they didn't. You look back at the music being made in punk rock's name at that time by the bands that I write about, and I can't find a single song about which one needs to say, oh, those were different times. They're very progressive and open-minded. Huh. But yeah, white guys everywhere. It's a white guy sausage fest, Madeline.
Yeah, so Green Day, they had a gay punk band open for them. Promoted them. Mm.
Yes, they did. The band that they had opened for them were and are called Pansy Division. Not only did they sing pretty much solely about being gay, it was largely about gay sex as well.
We don't feel like we think we should.
Green Day took them out on tour, not once, but twice. The second time was in big arenas. I mean, they played Madison Square Garden. And a lot of promoters in a lot of towns were not happy about this and tried to get the support band removed from the bill. But Green Day stood their ground and told them that either both bands played or neither band played. At the Cobo Hall in Detroit, Pansy Division picked up $38 in change from the stage, from the floor of the stage, at the end of their performance because they'd been pelted about coins. And I would like to think that Pansy Division particularly, but Green Day, in giving them the oxygen of publicity, helped move things along in what I hope we can all agree is the correct direction of travel.
And where is it now, this music? Is it dead, punk rock?
Well, as with, you know, Aerosmith's Dream On, which is an amazing song, being responsible for so many dreadful hair metal power ballads, so too mainstream punk rock's legacy has not been universally great. But at the same time, I don't want to criticize listeners now who are 18 and finding their own thing, in the way that punks from 76 criticized listeners in 94. So there is that as well. I'm reluctant to do that.
What is it about LA, do you think? Why does it flourish here?
You know what? I don't really know. But there is something about it that creates music that is sometimes violent in its intensity, you know. And you know, Slayer come from LA as well, you know, and NWA come from LA. It's not always, you know, the music of Laurel Canyon anymore. I mean, you've got palm trees everywhere. Why are people so angry?
Because, you know, those palm trees give no shade.
No, they really don't. And do you know what? There's nowhere to sit down either when you're walking.
So that can engender some anger.
Yeah, there you go. There's nowhere to sit down and you can't sit beneath a palm tree. That's my answer.
That's a great explanation. As good as any.
There you go. Yeah, sure.
Ian, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you.
Madeline, it's been my pleasure too. Thank you very much.
Ian Winwood, author of the new book, Smash, Green Day, The Offspring, Bad Religion, NoFX, and the 90s Punk Explosion. All right, Headbangers, that's it for me. Thanks for joining us. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow. When you're feeling too close to the bottom, you know who it is.